Welcome to another episode of The Human Way. I'm your host, Matt Havens. And on today's episode, I talked with Chris Field, who is the founder and executive director of The Mercy Project, a nonprofit that is aimed at eradicating child slavery in Ghana. Chris is the author of A Billion Hours of Good, where he takes some of the lessons learned during this journey and how we can choose to add goodness to the world if we focus on compassion, courage, and creativity. I was really inspired by Chris's message around what it means to stop waiting and be the action in the world and in the life that we see. So I'm excited for you to hear from Chris. Let's get into it. Chris, thank you so much for joining this episode today. I'm excited to talk with you.
Matt, thank you. I'm excited to be here.
So I could go through like kind of the bio for folks, you know, the author, speaker, consultant, world record holder, which I think we need to get into. But just tell the audience a little bit about who you are and what you're into these days.
Yeah. So the biggest thing that I like to always share with people, the last 11 years, that other stuff is fun. I enjoy all those other things, but really my passion project, the thing that I've poured so much of myself into the last 11 years, that's really given me the platform to speak and the platform to write and the passion to do those things, is the anti-trafficking nonprofit that my wife and I started in Ghana, Africa, 11 years ago. I read a book about children who'd been trafficked into the fishing industry. At that time, even though now a lot of people are talking about human trafficking, which is great, 11 years ago, it wasn't really on anybody's radar. No one was talking about it. And we were about to have our first baby. And I just remember feeling so crushed that all these hopes and dreams I had for this little girl that we were about to bring into the world, that I would do anything I could to protect her, that there was children 4, 5, 6 years old that were working 14, 15 hours a day fishing. And it was just the contrast of those two realities. I'm like literally looking at my wife's belly as I'm reading this book and thinking about all my hopes for my daughter, and then thinking like, who's hoping those hopes for these children? And so I Googled the author of that book, called her, found her, obviously called her, asked her to go to Africa with her, showed up in Ghana with her 3 months later. And about a year later, I quit my job and started a nonprofit to try and advocate on behalf of these children. And so to date, we've rescued more than 200 children and reunited them back into their families where they're all attending school, and we hope and believe becoming the future leaders of Ghana. So that's the most important thing I do. The other stuff is fun and exciting, but that's by far the most meaningful thing that I do.
Well, first off, amazing for you to take that leap and go do that, because, you know, I think you and I were talking, you know, earlier before we started recording about how sometimes it's just taking that act that really stops people. Right. Yeah. And we hear about some of these awful, horrible things that are happening, but because it's not right in front of us, we don't literally see it every day outside of our windows or doors. It kind of feels like it's gone and out of sight. And so obviously, you know, you said the birth of your child kind of maybe compelled you to act in a different way, but what else inspired you to really go that far to say, hey, 3 months later, I'm going to be there on the ground because I need to help.
Yeah. So one thing I like to remind people is by the time I went to Ghana, I was a decade deep into trying to respond to needs around me when I saw them. And I think sometimes people look at Ghana and they get kind of intimidated, like, oh, well, I can't do that. It's like compassion, empathy, courage, generosity, those are muscles. And they get bigger when we exercise them. And when, you know, the willingness to say, hey, someone should do something about that, why not me? That really started when I was 19 years old. I was a freshman in college. I ran for mayor of my hometown. We had about 50,000 people in my hometown. I ran for mayor. I got third place out of 5 candidates. And then about 3 months after that election, I was hired to direct a camp for inner city kids. It's basically a camp for kids in Texas who couldn't afford to go to summer camp. So I'm basically like 1 year older than some of these campers. They're 18 years old, and half my staff is older than me. And it was crazy that the directors hired me or that the board hired me to be the camp director, but they saw something in me. And I even had people I knew and loved and valued. They were like, hey, you shouldn't take that job. And I was like, why not? This is a great job. And they're like, you could fail. Like, think about how hard that job is going to be. And I'm like, what? Like, that's not how we're going to do this thing. Like, that's not the, of course you could fail. Like, anything worthy of doing is going to have some element of possible failure at it. But so from 19, I really started looking at the world around me and saying, like, hey, what needs to be done? And what gifts do I have? What resources do I have? What time do I have? What talent do I have today to do the best I can in that thing? And so sometimes, again, when people see Ghana, they get really intimidated, like, oh, well, I could never dot, dot, dot. And it's like, hold on. Those small things that we say yes to along the way, the person on the side of the road, helping kids in our local neighborhood learn how to read, you name it. I can name it. I could literally go through 150 things right now. The people you meet today that you slow down enough to look them in the eye and to really ask how they're doing and to really mean it. It stacks up on each other. And so what it does, it makes you better. You get stronger. And so when you see children trafficked in another country, you don't find all the reasons you couldn't do anything. You say, oh gosh, someone should do something about that. Well, I've been doing stuff about problems, not this problem and not this big, but 10 years I've been trying to solve problems. Like, I'll try. And of course, in retrospect, I knew it could fail. I mean, of course I knew it might fail. But for me, the greater failure was being a person who was paralyzed by the chance of failure. That doing nothing just wasn't, it was no longer an option for me. That's not how I functioned. And so I think we have to get comfortable, get those small wins, let some snowball, you know, let the snowball effect be a benefit to you on those small little wins. And when you do that, you'll realize you're going after the big stuff without being as worried about it being big, quote unquote.
Yeah. So what I kind of call that, and I talk about this in some of the work that I do, is it's, in a way, it's creating opportunities to fail.
Yeah.
And what I love is that, because I just came off of a keynote this weekend where we talked about just this fear that we have as humans to fail. And it's very surprising me. The number one fear people have is public speaking, which again is ridiculous, because one is clowns and so is two. But the second one is this fear of failure. Where some statistics you look at, it's 35 to 40% of people. The second thing they're scared of is failure. But you at 19, and I think that's, and I don't know, this is just my opinion, maybe, that I'm kind of glad these things happen to you early in life.
Yeah.
Because when we're younger like that, we don't have those same fears. We haven't been burned by things in the past. We haven't allowed, in some cases, our situation, or in other cases, we didn't allow other people to tell us that you need to be worried about this, or you need to be scared to go out and try this. So very early on, you realized, hey, it's okay. Yes, I'm going to fail. I'm not going to worry about that. I'm going to be more worried maybe about the regret of not doing something.
Yeah.
Or the regret of not trying.
Yeah. And I think that resonates with all of us. Like at a core level, we all feel that. I mean, the validation I have for that is my first book, Disrupting for Good. There's, you know, the nice thing about having a Kindle and a paperback version of your book, or a hardcover and Kindle, is you can see what people found the most meaningful in a Kindle, because you get to see what the most popular highlights are. On a hard copy, you don't know, right?
Yep.
And the number one most underlined sentence in the first version of the book, and I didn't see this coming. Like, I didn't write this line and think like, oh yeah,
this is it.
You know, maybe I should title my book this. I was like, no, it was one of the things I wrote. I felt it. I wrote it. But it's a line I say. My life, and I was talking about when I was 19 years old, I say, my life was changed forever when my willingness to do great things outgrew my fear of failure. And so I think the reason that's resonated so deeply is because it acknowledges that tension we have. We want to do great things. All of us, everyone wants to live a life of purpose. Like, I never meet anybody who's like, you know, Chris, I want to be as mediocre and below average as possible. My goal is to get to death and have done nothing great. Like, no,
I just
want to
go through it. Yeah.
Yeah. I just coast. If I could just cruise, if everyone, you know, no one says that. But at the same time, we all have these fears. We all have these fears of being vulnerable, fear of failing, fears of what other people will say about us, fears of financial stability, all name all the things. But for me, I think the reason that line has resonated as I've reflected on it, because I was surprised that it was so popular. I thought, you know, I think what I wrote there without realizing it was that tension that everyone feels, that we all feel both of those things, but in many of our lives, the fear is stronger than Absolutely. The desire to do great things.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, that was totally flipped for me at 19. Like if you ask me my greatest fear, what you said, my greatest fear is to live a life of insignificance. Mm-hmm. Like more than anything, like I'm like, that terrifies me to get to the end of my life. And it's like, this was it. Like that I paid my mortgage and I went on a couple cool vacations. Like that's my legacy. Like, oh no. Like that, I get like butterflies even thinking about that. Like that makes me like terrified. It's like, no, I want to do things that outlast my lifetime. I want to do things that will live far beyond, even if I die now, I want to know that there's things that will live beyond my life. And so that was a driver for me. And fear was there, right? Yeah. People was asking me like, oh, aren't you scared? Like, I'm scared. I'm scared just like you are. But that fear doesn't drive my decision-making. It's there. It's present. I name it. I acknowledge it. I do not let it own me. I do not let it control me. I do not let it drive my decision-making matrix. It's there. It's present. I'm aware of it.
Yeah, you're aware of it.
But it doesn't drive my decision-making matrix. What drives my decision-making matrix is impact. Mm-hmm. And that's it. And at the end of the day, if I care more about impact than I do about failure, I'm going to make a heck of a difference in the world. And I will fail along the way. But it's not going to matter. I knew that up front. I knew that was never in question whether I was going to fail. The question was, am I willing to do the things to make an impact that will mean some failures, even though that's a, you know, that word is whatever. Succeed or learn, right? Succeed or learn. It is a failure when we didn't learn from it. And when we repeat the mistake over and over and over, but most of us don't do that. We learn it. We grow from it and we move better. We move on. We're better people.
Absolutely. And you're right about that word too, because when I speak it, sometimes audiences or whoever I'm talking to goes towards the worst, you know, level of failure that you might think of, right? Like if you're talking about bankruptcy or you lost your job or, you know, somebody lost their life, you know, like they go to these far extremes.
Right.
And I think we sometimes don't realize that like, you can fail 100 times in a day at little things. And as we kind of talk, that's why I use that word, is because I want to get people more comfortable with this idea that we fail every day. And I think you've kind of described that as well too, even in the great impacts that you've made with your work. I'm sure you've had some little failures along the way.
Not little. I have not had little failures. Not little failures. Massive. Matt, I mean, what we tried to do to go into Ghana was ridiculous. I mean, it was crazy. I mean, we're teaching people with first and second grade education how to run an aquaculture cage fishing business to replace the labor of the children. I mean, we would not have time in 10 podcasts for me to tell you all the ways I've failed in Ghana. It'd be impossible. But that's not the story of Mercy Project, right? The story is one that we cared.
Yeah,
that we let ourselves feel, that we weren't so numb with all the crappy things that happened in the world, that we didn't numb ourselves with food and alcohol and drugs and social media. And we weren't just like, yeah, well, it's just life's hard. You know, life's hard. Like, okay, we fell, we let ourselves feel. And then second, that we actually showed up, that we had the courage to actually show up. I mean, that's the story beyond any success we ever did or didn't have, is that we felt something and we let ourselves use that feeling to show up in Ghana. And anything that happens after that is gravy. I mean, it's just like, this is great. And dude, yeah, there's so many failures. There's no question. If somebody's telling you they're not failing when they're doing something hard, they either don't understand what failure is, or they're not telling you the truth. That's it. That's the only two options, because there is no option where they're not failing. It's impossible.
That's a big one. I think more often we need to recognize that not everybody's fully aware, maybe that we all do it. But so tell me a little bit about that first trip. The first trip when you go over, you said you called the author of the book, and 3 months later you're on the ground. I mean, what was that experience like, or what sort of happened that then obviously compelled you to come home, leave your job, and start this nonprofit?
Yeah, I mean, that first trip was crazy, man. I mean, we're out in the middle. It's the world's largest man-made lake, Lake Volta. It was created in the late 1950s to create hydroelectricity. They created this giant, insane dam, flooded in this valley between these two rivers. I mean, it's insane. It's so massive. And I mean, just going out there, and it's one thing to read in a book about kids. It's another thing to be sitting next to a fishing boat with a little kid in it who's just sitting there holding a net, just wondering what these people are doing, talking to his master, you know. And it was crazy, man. I mean, it was indescribable. It was beautiful, and it was terrible. The people of Ghana are the most hospitable, unbelievably gracious. I mean, they would put pre-prison Martha Stewart to shame, just like in the hospitality, just like so kind, give you the shirt off their back, the food off their plate. And yet there's just this horrible thing happening. That's just been a generational thing that's happened, because that's how you fish. When you work on Lake Volta, you fish by using child labor from poor families. And it's like there was never a reimagination that there could be a different way. Nobody had ever been, no one ever even slowed down enough to ask the question. So I take all that in, you know, for 7, 8, 9 days, 10 days, and come home. And we're a couple months now from having the baby, and I'm just sitting on my couch, just weeping. I'm just like literally crying, like sobbing. And my wife is, you know, so gracious. And she's just like, what do we need to do? What do we need to do? You know, dangerous question, 7 months.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm just like, we got to do something. Like, we got to tell this story. I can't see this story and not tell it. And so we sent out these terrible little DVDs that we made, like on iMovie on our, you know, Macs, and, you know, hilariously bad in retrospect. But the point to again is that we did something. We had iMovie, and we had some still photos, and we had some stats. And so we made a bad little DVD, and we wrote a letter, and we mailed it to 50 of our friends, 75 of our friends. We said, hey, we're going to try to raise enough money to build a house for some of these kids to live in. You know, we need $40,000. Let us know if you want to be a part of it. And people just started sending checks, you know. And to make the long story short, for the sake of the podcast, one of the people who sent us a check, very large check, tens of thousands, was a cousin of my wife's, who is a consultant, very successful consultant. And he reached out, he called me. We'd only met once at our wedding. We didn't remember one another, which is hilarious because we're a lot alike.
Yeah.
We didn't remember each other, but he said, you know, I'm really intrigued. We mailed you a check. He says it like totally understated. I'm like, you mailed me a $25,000 check. I remember the check.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he's like, you know, we mailed you a check. You might remember. I'm like, oh yeah. Yeah. I remember. Right. And he's like, but more than the check, I'm wondering, I have some other questions about why the problem's happening. And I couldn't really answer his question. You know, I was like, well, here's what I've been told. Here's what I've been told. He's like, well, could you take us over there? Could you host us on a trip? And I'm like, man, I've been one time. I'm not sure that I'm the host. And he's like, well, you've been one more time than us. So we go over there. We fly over there together. And I start showing him what's going on. We start asking questions and digging. He's a consultant. I mean, consultants have a different way of looking at the world. And,
yep.
And he worked, you know, he works with huge Fortune 100 companies, similar to a lot of the work that you've done and been at it a long time. And so he's like, we're sitting around this plastic table late in the trip, end of the trip, eating bad chicken, drinking warm beer, rickety little chairs. And he's like, why don't you give your life to this? And I'm like, what? And so my daughter's 6 months old at this time. He's like, you know, why aren't you doing this? He's like, you are so alive, like watching you. You've only been here twice, but you act like you run this place, like in a respectful way. Like everybody loves you. You're asking great questions. You know, the people are asking you to preach at their churches and, you know, like pray over their babies, and, you know, they want to take pictures with you. It's like your impact here could be huge, and it's clear you love this. why aren't you doing this instead of what you're doing in America? And I said, well, to be honest, it's a matter of taking that jump. Like we have a young baby at home. I don't even know how I'd raise enough money to pay my own salary, much less actually do good with the money, which I wouldn't want to just raise money to raise my salary. I was pretty early on in my working career at this point. I was doing nonprofit work, so I wasn't making any money at all. And he's like, how much money do you make? And I told him, and he said, we'll write a check for that for your first year salary. And I'm like, ugh. Like you just took my objection away.
You just mowed it down.
Just took my objection away, which is, you know, we tell people all the time, it's exactly what you should do, right? Mm-hmm. Because it really wasn't about the money.
It wasn't, no.
It really wasn't about the money. It was about, I don't know how to do this. And it feels really scary. And as long as I have the money thing, then I have a reason. 99 out of 100 people are going to say, oh, of course, totally reasonable. Well, unfortunately for me, I was sitting around the table in Ghana with the one out of the 100 that saw it wasn't the money and called me on it. And so 4 months later, I quit my job and we went for it. So that's just a little bit of context of how that first trip went and then what the months were like after that.
Well, and what I love about that story is obviously then what's become of it. That's probably first and foremost, but also just how sometimes the world works if we're willing to open our eyes and look at it and see it. Because here's a situation where somebody that you have met once before, you know, through family at the wedding, don't remember it. And I got, sorry to anybody that's listening, I got a few people at our wedding that I don't remember that were there either. But then, you know, two conversations in, like that conversation and the impact that it made, because somebody's willing to kind of really, in a way, call you on what maybe you don't see in that moment.
Absolutely.
And how, if we're willing to like open our eyes and have those conversations with people and with new people sometimes, like where that can take you. You know, not expecting that it's always going to come in the place that you find it, but sometimes it's going to come at a complete surprise. And if you're willing to run with it, then some amazing things can happen.
Yeah. And I think it's a reminder for me, Matt, of just the power of speaking into one another's lives. I think we tiptoe around for whatever reason, you know, we're so hesitant to speak plainly to one another. I don't mean rudely. I'm talking about even on the opposite side. Like we're like, oh, especially men are terrible at this. It's like, why are we so bad at naming these powerful truths? And what, like, we feel, it's like we feel threatened, right? We see a young person coming up behind us and they're ripe to just crush it, right? And it's like, instead of us coming into them and seeing, naming something they can't even understand themselves, it's like we almost feel more threatened by that. But like for me, I could name the 2, 3, 4, 5 conversations that completely were transformational for me, because one with my wife, we dated and we were high school sweethearts, and I was a little jerk, a little punk, and she was precious and kind, and she saw something in me way before anybody but my mother ever saw. And people told her she was crazy. They were like, she would tell her friends, they're like, who are you dating? She's like, Chris. And they're like, is he the one that almost ran me over in the parking lot with the loud music? And she's like, I'm sorry, he's so sweet. You know, and they're like, I don't think he is. It's like, she saw something in me. She's like, you can be so great. Like, I mean, she was 16 years old and she was like, hey, you could be greater than anybody I've ever met in my life. Like, I've never met anybody who has some of these characteristics you do. You're just using them in the wrong way. Mm-hmm. You're just using, and like, from that moment on, I could name 3 or 4, the guy who hired me at the camp, who fought for me with the board of directors. They were like, hold on, Chris. And he was like, trust me. And they were like, are we talking about the same guy? And he's like, trust me. And they hired me because he vouched for me. He was the executive director and I was the camp director. And it was the best 4 years in that camp's history. But I would have never applied for that job in a million years. I wasn't qualified. But he came to me and he said, Chris, you not only should you apply for this job, I'm telling you right now, you're my number one pick to the board. I'm fighting for you to get this job. And I'm like, you shouldn't have done that. But it's like, he spoke a new reality into me that I didn't even know I was capable of. And so, and then that's what my friend Dean did in Ghana, was he said, you know, he named truths about me that were incredible and have, you know, I tell, I mean, my second book, A Billion Hours of Good, I wrote it. I dedicated it to Dean because I said, your investment in me, every good thing that's ever come of my life because of the work of Mercy Project has your fingerprints on it, because that's the power of amplification. That's the power of mentorship.
Yep.
Is now I'm touching people on your podcast that will never meet Dean, whose lives might be made marginally better because Dean saw something in me and said something. So, man, it's so powerful. Words are so powerful. And I hope all of us listening and just living today will realize we have that power to speak truth into people's lives in a way that can truly be transformational.
Well, and I think we have the choice to do that, right?
Yes.
That's another big thing is sometimes for whatever reasons, right? You just named a few, right? There's this social anxiety maybe that people have, or in some cases it's definitely the you're speaking truth about the men and how we sometimes talk certainly to each other. Like we have a choice in how we respond to those and what we say and what we do. But you mentioned something that I think would be really good for the audience to hear about, that I wanted to talk to you about as well is your most recent book, Billion Hours of Good, which I think is kind of like the, and you can speak to this, but I think it's kind of the next iteration. It's the next sort of jump, not only coming off of what you're doing at the Mercy Project, but just this message for people. So can you explain a little bit about Billion Hours of Good and you know, why you wrote it and a little bit about the message within it?
Yeah. So a lot of it is what people have been hearing me talk about so far, which is, you know, as I looked at what we've done at Mercy Project, as I looked at what we've done in other ventures and other projects, and even all the way back to my time at the camp, I mean, I get asked all the time, like, hey, what are some themes? What are some through lines? What would you tell somebody if they were at, how do you summarize 20 years of your life? And it's like, okay, you know, I know I want to reverse engineer it. Like, even though I didn't necessarily have these processes going in, why have we ended up doing what we've ended up doing? What are those guideposts, those markers along the way that are consistent in everything? And so those three things were compassion, courage, and creativity, that they were there. They were present in everything good we ever did. We felt, we let ourselves feel, first of all. We had the courage to show up even when we didn't know what would happen next. And then we were willing to try to solve old problems in new ways, not to say, well, that's how we always do it, or, you know, that's a great idea, but that's not how we do it around here. It's, you know, it's like, okay, come on. So I was like, okay, but how do I help just the average person, people I meet all the time, and they're like, gosh, I wish I could do what you're doing. I'm like, why don't you? Why aren't you doing what I'm doing? And over and over and over, the same answer, people would say, I don't have time. I don't have time, and I don't know what to do. Okay. So I thought, okay, I'm going to write a book that's going to overcome both those objections. So it's called A Billion Hours of Good, Changing the World 14 Minutes a Day. 14 minutes at a time. 14 minutes is exactly 1% of our day. So you take a 24-hour day times 60 minutes divided by 100 is 14.4. I round it down to 14. Every one of us has 14 minutes a day. No question. Zero. You cannot argue that whatsoever. So the idea is that we're waiting for these big, grand, huge, elaborate moments. And we're waiting for those to happen for years and for decades. And all the while, we're crapping away these little moments we have every single day. And those, just like the stock market, where it's time in the market more than nailing the timing of the market, that 14 minutes a day adds up to 2 hours a week, 8 hours a month, 100 hours a year. So you take somebody in their 20s, and they've got 40 years of their working career, 100 hours, that's 4,000 hours. And that's insane. I mean, that's, you know, a bunch of hours for an hourly employee, or for a full-time employee, is 2,000 hours a year, right? That's what they always say, lawyers would try to bill 2,000 hours a year.
Yep.
That's like 2 years of meaningfulness. So this is, okay, fine, Chris. Okay. You found 14 minutes a day, but well, I don't even know where to start. I mean, look at all the problems in the world. It's like, start where you are with what you have. That's it. Stop overcomplicating. If you have $1 right now, then probably money is not the way that you're going to start. Mm-hmm. But you're surrounded by people every single day. Every one of those people has a story. Every one of them are hurting in some way. Every one of them feels unseen and unvalued and unappreciated in some way. And there are some people who are really listening. There are people with some significant pain around us, right under the surface. And none of that costs money. It costs our intentionality. That's it. Yeah. It costs us to stop being selfish and to slow down just a tiny bit and to be a little more purposeful when we check in with people. And so that's really the book, is to overcome those two objections and then to show you, when you're willing to find that little bit of time every day, and when you're willing to start where you are with what you have, which is plenty, and you take those two things and you add compassion, you're willing to feel, courage, you're willing to show up, and creativity, you're willing to solve old problems in new ways, then the amount of good that we can do together, 1 billion hours is the goal, is that people would pledge they're going to give that 14 minutes a day. And that a couple hundred thousand people making that pledge ends up being 1 billion hours, which is 114,000 years of good, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for 114,000 years, which clearly none of us could ever do. Mother Teresa herself couldn't do that much good, but that's the power of a bunch of people showing up where they are with what they have and just giving a little bit at a time. So that's really what the book's about.
I love it. And especially the time one, right? Like 14 minutes a day.
Yeah.
And you're right. You can't defend it. I was trying to think of like, how can I creatively or humorously combat 14 minutes? And I can't, because yeah. It's just absolutely, we all have 14 minutes to help out. So I'm curious if you get this sort of objection or this, especially the creativity one, right? Because, that's what I often hear people say is, no, you know what? I've got the time. And you're right. Maybe I don't know where to start. But if I can figure those two out, I just don't know how to do it differently. I'm not creative. That's not me. I'm a feeler, and I'm good with the emotions, but I can't think like that. How do you sort of try to help people understand that they are more creative than they maybe give themselves credit?
And first of all, people listening to this, if they've never read this report, they need to just Google. I actually literally just Googled to make sure I was giving the right search terms. Just literally Google NASA, NASA study on creativity.
Okay.
So let me summarize it, and then you need to go read it. So NASA was having a hard time hiring engineers that were able to be creative. They were great engineers, but they were struggling to pivot. This is like in the 60s. So they brought in these two researchers that say, hey, develop an assessment so that before we hire an engineer, we can tell if they're creative or not. Because we need to not just have great engineers, we need to have great engineers who are able to think creatively, because what we're trying to do, go to the moon, it's going to have a lot of trouble. And we need people who can pivot quickly and think outside the box, because literally we don't even have a box, okay?
Yeah.
So these two researchers came in, they built this assessment, and it was freaking amazing. It was great, it worked great. They thought, this is interesting. What if we use this assessment on the general population now that it's worked for NASA engineers? So they went out, they took thousands of five-year-olds, and they gave them this assessment to test their creativity. And 97% of these five-year-olds came back as creative geniuses. Such a stupid number, you think it's not true. It's like, is this a MailChimp survey? Like, is this survey?
Yeah.
No, this is a scientifically rigorous study, 97%. Then they tracked those kids as they got older. Guess what happened? They got less creative. Because especially in the American education system, we don't value creativity. We value right or wrong answers. We value black or white, red or blue, left or right. And look, go on social media right now. There's no nuance. Our politicians don't know how to give nuance, none. It's a lost art to be able to see both sides of an issue, to be able to think, you know, I see this and I see this, but I think there's a third way. No one's doing that anymore. It doesn't make headlines. God knows it doesn't get you elected.
Yeah.
And so we're just going further and further where people have this convergent way of thinking, like there has to be a right or wrong answer. There's nothing in the middle. And that's just not life. Life is not right or wrong. And on almost anything, every situation is complex and messy. That's humanity. So the beautiful thing is that everyone listening to this, you are more creative than you think. You're just, you've lost it. But as 5 years old, 96 out of 100 of you were creative geniuses. And so what we have to do is we have to find ways to refine that creativity. We have to play more. We have to tap into that divergent thinking more, which is the part of your brain that comes up with fun ideas. By the way, the divergent part of your brain, yes, this is where the divergent series came from for anybody who's wondering, but that divergent part of your brain is also the part of your brain that gives you crazy ideas when you're, let's think about it, in the shower, driving on a familiar road home from work, on a run, mowing the yard, picking weeds out of the garden, like waking up in the middle of the night and you have an idea. Why does that happen? It's because your convergent part of your brain, it's always, what's next? What time is it? What time did Matt say we were finished? How long is this? What's going to, that part of your brain is not active when you're in the shower and you have just 5 minutes to just relax, or when you're freaking asleep in the middle of the night, right? Like, and so that divergent part of your brain can take over, and that divergent part of your brain is the one that has all the ideas, the one that's, oh, what if we this and what if we that? So we have to find ways to tap into that divergent part of our brain and to give ourselves freedom to play, give ourselves freedom to come up with bad ideas. I mean, one of my favorite quotes in my book when I'm talking about creativity is, there's this guy who's a consultant for schools, and he says, the first idea is almost always the best idea, not because we ever end up using it, but because it's the one that got all the other ideas started.
Yep.
And I love that. It's like, just start writing stuff down. It's going to be stupid. You're going to laugh about it. It's going to be terrible, but like, you're not going to get to the ninth idea if you don't get to the first eight that are bad. And so we got to give ourselves some grace around creativity. We have to think of it more as an art than a science. And also, creativity is not painting. It's not pottery. I'm horrible as an artist. Like, my kids we're like playing Pictionary. My kids are like, I don't want to be on dad's team. Like, they want to be on my team on everything else. Not Pictionary. Like, dad is out. Let me be the scorekeeper, man. This is bad. This is really bad. But I'm not an artist in that way, but I'm absolutely an artist when it comes to creatively solving problems, because it's a muscle that I've forced myself to exercise 1,000 times over and over and over. I try to think of new ways to solve old problems to where I can do it now. I can do it seems very easy, but it's because my brain goes, oh, I know how to do this.
Well,
I've been doing for so long.
And I think too, I think what I hope listeners are also getting from that is you're creating those opportunities for yourself to think creatively.
Yeah.
You're allowing time for it to happen. Yeah, and you're pushing past that, and you know, it's one of the things I've gotten into like very recently is journaling, and doing that not with the intention of I've always tried for years to get into it, and I'll do it for a couple of weeks and I'll stop. But what I've done recently that's helped stick a little bit is I stopped worrying about that part of your brain that's like, what do I have to write,
right?
And what's next? What am I going to say next? And I've tried to teach myself to just, I am going to write for 10 minutes and it doesn't matter what it is, as long as it just write. And
yeah,
the first couple of weeks were really hard. You know, it's like, I've got nothing in there. I don't know what to do. But as you force yourself to kind of just spend a little bit more time, have that divergent thinking start to happen, now it is becoming easier. It's easier to then jump from parallels and jump to ideas and things that are maybe in the back of my brain that haven't really come forward yet.
Yeah.
And so I think I think your point about allowing yourself to think is one of the easiest first steps that we can take towards being creative. Cause you're right. I'm not jumping with the kids to do any drawing because I can't help you there. And I don't know that I can solve every single problem creatively, but I know that I'm willing to sit down. If this camera were to pan out, I have so many whiteboards in this room, because that's just, all right, right. Just start writing down. Let's see what happens, see where it takes us. And some of the ideas that are on these boards will never see the light of day. They will never go past this room, because as you come back to them a week later, you're like, yeah, that's not going to work.
Yeah. But you know, the idea that will never make it out into the world is the one you don't write down on the whiteboard.
Absolutely.
And you don't know when you start writing ideas on the whiteboard which ones are good and bad. That's the whole freaking point.
That's the point. That's the point.
You don't know, right? But you need 1 out of 100 to be great. You know, you need 1 out of 100, 1 out of 50 to be great, to create real transformation, to totally turn your own life around and other people's lives along the way. I mean, that's the beauty of it, is it's a numbers game. You don't have to get it right every time. You just have to get your reps in and right, and not just be paralyzed, you know, but that what you write or what you say is not going to be perfect. So
you're right. And to your point, and what I really hope that people, I think there's a lot that they can take from this whole conversation, but one of the things that resonated with me when we first talked and hearing it again is, and you're absolutely right, is stop waiting.
Yeah.
Start with where you are. Be the action today,
right,
in whatever that is. And yeah, maybe the people listening won't do the things that they think are as impactful as some of the work you've done, like going to Ghana and helping solve this very, very big real problem. But even just taking the little steps now, the 14 minutes every day, right, can have such a big impact.
Yeah. And it takes everybody. I mean, that's what's crazy. Like, Just a silly example. We have 50 kids that we've rescued in Ghana that don't have monthly child sponsors to help them go to school. So maybe you can't go to Ghana, but I bet you can pull your kids in and say, like, hey, we have a really good life. Let's do something that's meaningful to help a child who doesn't have some of what you have. You can, I mean, that's one silly example. So like, when I look at even our work in Ghana, it's like, we wouldn't be where we are if everyone who'd ever helped us had just wanted to go to Ghana to do what I did. We didn't need 1,000 of me.
Yeah.
But we needed people who did all those other things along the way, that believed in us, that invited me to speak, that were donors early on, early adopters before we had any success. I mean, I needed all those people to do what they had where they were, or we wouldn't have ever gotten to where we are today. And those, so I think people undermine sometimes, right?
They wonder,
well, I can't do that big thing, so I'll do nothing. And it's, you know, you mentioned writing. I have an example in my book. You know, you write 150 words a day, which is a medium length email. And at the end of 1 year, you've written a 50,000 word book, which is how long A Billion Hours of Good is. And it's like, well, everybody can write 150 words a day. It's like, you know what? They don't.
You're right.
And they certainly don't do it with the diligence and the discipline of doing it 365 days in a row. And so, like, that's just such a great example that if you start, it doesn't matter how tiny the action is. If you literally committed to doing it every single day, it's transformational. And there's no question that it's going to make a big difference, bigger than you can even imagine. So you just have to start doing it.
You just got to start. And to your point about that, what I think the statistics are, maybe what, 21 days becomes a habit. Yep. So writing 150 words for 21 days becomes a habit. Yep. Spending 14 minutes finding good and doing good creates a habit. So I think that would be the challenge I'd give to anybody who's listening, is your clock starts today.
Yeah.
You got 21 days to start that habit in whatever realm you deem it appropriate. But you've definitely given me some things to think about, Chris, that I'm excited to kind of dive into over the course of certainly in the next 21 days. Tell everybody, obviously the books are out on Amazon. We got Billion Hours of Good, Disrupting for Good. How can they get involved with the Mercy Project if they're compelled to do so?
Yeah, so mercyproject.net is the website for Mercy Project. And if people want to reach out to me personally, meetchrisfield.com is my website, and all the socials, I'm Disruption Chris. So love to connect with anybody listening. And if there's any ways to work together to create meaningfulness and purpose, and I'm happy to do that.
Well, Chris, I appreciate you sharing that. And I mean, I've got 3 pages of notes here that I've taken from you. I'm going to make sure that we also put that NASA study of creativity in the link for the episode, because I think that would be good. the other thing I just want to leave, I want to leave people with as we close out here is because you kind of said it very quickly. You know, when you think about the stock market, it's not about timing the market. It's about time in the market. And I think if we, as people, as humans, if we continue, if we make sure that we're putting time in each other, and do that every single day. And like you said, these aren't black and white issues. These aren't black and white feelings that people have about certain situations or each other or relationships. If we can spend some time with each other figuring out, I think we're going to realize that there is a third option. There is a fourth option. And the world would be a better place if we continue to do that. So thank you everybody for listening. And thank you, Chris, again, for joining. Really, really appreciate it. And we'll see you guys in the next episode.